This record is one of a series sponsored by the Friends of the Spokane Public Library. Today, May 20th, 1970, Miss Edith Boyd will tell of the Indians of Spokane. Miss Boyd?
Indians of Spokane. On the first day we came to Spokane in 1884, my father took us for a walk to see our new hometown. We crossed the Post Street Bridge, just completed. I know that, for I saw a new white shaving curl lying by the railing. The roaring of the falls filled all the air, and the spray splashed on my face. Away from the spray side, we looked over the rail into a piney bench down low by the water. Among the trees was a camp of teepees. Children and dogs ran around seemingly without any noise. In silence, two moccasin-footed figures passed by, bent low under bundles of straw piled above their heads. They passed us, and soon we saw them feeding the straw to the ponies below the bridge. Blanket-draped figures, both men and women, walked the town streets or sat in doorways of stores and on the curbs. Silent, they were usually, but not Curly Jim, who sat or stood all day on the steps of the Trader's Bank. From this perch, he learned to know prominent citizens and hailed them by name as they passed. "Hi, Sam Slocum. You give me Sitcom, half a dollar, for supper?" Or, "Hello, Ada Foster. Got donut for me in that bag?" And usually the coin or food changed hands. On the ground, where the Payless drugstore now is, was the Haymarket, so called, where Indians had a sort of trading spot, exchanging ponies, straw, skins, or whatever goods they had, with white men who went there to trade. Whole Indian families camped there for the day, and their little smudge fires and smell of food proved them quite comfortable anywhere. There were no large camps within miles of Spokane, but clusters of three or four teepees were often pitched in vacant lots or near houses. When the J.J. Browns lived at Pacific and Oak, a group of three to five teepees stood in the pines about 100 feet away. Mrs. Brown said Indians were good neighbors, friendly, quiet, never coming too near, and never taking what was not their own. There was a large camp at the foot of the mountains in what is now the Minnehaha district. The main home, though, was in Indian Canyon, west of town, deep in the hills. Toward evening, there was an exodus from town, when, from the Haymarket and elsewhere, the Indian families went west on Riverside Avenue and down the hill, across Hangman Creek, and out of sight. The young men seemed to gather in order to storm west along Riverside at full speed, yelling and shrieking, slashing and lashing their ponies on one side and then the other as they tore down Brown's Hill, across the creek, and disappeared into the forest. After that, slowly, deliberately, would come old Chief Gary on his white horse with its stringy tail. Indian women worked in white homes, washing clothes or cleaning. Gary's daughter, Nellie, rode a spotted cayuse in our neighborhood, and we children had an adventure jogging around on him while Nellie worked for the neighbors. After a while, not too long, we realized the absence of these women. The town had become too great for them, and the men that stalked along the streets, silent and idle, were gone too. Reservations drew them to themselves, and a picturesque and entering segment of life was missing. Once in a while, we'd see a few, dressed in shabby white folks' clothing, walking along our street aimlessly. And again, we would see well-clothed men, women, and young girls mingling and having a place in our citizenry. Some prominent early men of wealth and position married Indian women, and their children, handsome and refined, showed traces of their ancestry. I do not forget a picture I saw in the early days when we lived on Pacific Avenue and Maple Street in the 1800s. The forests came to town as far as Maple Street. One evening, two young Indian girls were walking slowly toward the pine woods when a soft music came drifting through the air. They lifted their heads as if listening, but did not turn or pause. A young Indian came from the direction of the riverbank, following the trail of the girls. He was playing sweet sounds on a flute-shaped pipe, short and a part of the evening romance, soft and a part of the evening romance. The three figures moved slowly into the pine woods. The final picture was not happy. When we lived in our home on the hill beyond Hangman Creek, we had to walk through an Indian camp on the flat at the end of the bridge. It consisted of six or seven teepees, well filled with all ages of the families, ponies and dogs gathered round. They covered a fair-sized space. We had no fear of them, for they rarely seemed to notice as we passed through their camp, or maybe they would return our nod of greeting. Their dogs allowed our passage. Indian dogs never bark. Did you know that? They are so trained. One morning, a group of us school children on our usual walk found the camp broken up. Teepees, people, all gone. Just disorder of things abandoned. Oh, yes, the city was putting a street through the flat place, so it had to be vacated. But it was not quite empty yet. A sight that caused us to stop and gaze curiously. Old Chief Gary, on his lean white horse, piled with a huge bundle, was picking his way through the debris. Led by a strap around her head, his wife Nina stumbled after them among rocks and obstacles. They were on their way to Indian Canyon. A boy standing by me yelled, "Yo, brute, get down and let her ride." He did not know that Gary was too lame to walk and Nina was blind.
Thank you, Miss Boyd.
Would you say that again? I didn't hear it.
Oh, thank you, Miss Boyd. Miss Boyd is 96 years young. So again, thank you.
Next week's my birthday.